Hi, everybody. Eve Harrow, Rejuvenation on the Land of Israel Network. It is moving towards the end of August 2nd, 2021, the beginning of the 25th of Av, 5781, here in Israel. And I'm really honored to have on the line Seth Frantzman, Dr. Seth Frantzman, who was born in Maine and is a correspondent at the Jerusalem Post and the author of After ISIS, America, Iran, and the Struggle for the Middle East. And as the director of the Mideast Center for Reporting and Analysis, he reported on conflict in Iraq, Jordan, Turkey, Egypt, and Israel. I guess you could call it somewhat of a growth industry. And, you know, Seth, thanks so much for joining me today. And I asked you specifically to come on the podcast because I'm fascinated by the book that you've just put out called Drone Wars, Pioneers, Killing Machines, Artificial Intelligence, and the Battle for the Future. And, you know, everybody talks about drones now. You see them like at every wedding, right, flying around, or just your neighbor might have one. And suddenly you look up and there's something spying on you from the window. But you're particularly talking about the drones that are used for warfare. So how did you get interested in this? I guess it's the newest or most upcoming level of weaponry.
It's definitely interesting. So what, basically, several years ago, I was covering the war against ISIS or Islamic State, which for a different book I was writing called After ISIS. And that was about in 2015, 16, 17, 18, those years. And I was going back and forth in those days to Turkey and Iraq and places like that. And we started to see, for instance, during the Battle of Mosul, which was this huge epic battle in which around 5,000 ISIS fighters were under siege in a huge city from around 50,000 Iraqi forces. And even though the Iraqi forces had, you know, American tanks and F-16s, everything, when we were going into the city, the ISIS guys had quadcopters and drones, small commercial drones they'd bought, and they'd put grenades and mortars on them, and they were dropping them onto the Iraqi forces. And the Iraqi forces were totally spooked and afraid. Every time they heard a bit of a buzzing, they wondered, is it one of ours or one of theirs? And they didn't have weapons to shoot the drones down. So that was a very, let's say, personal experience that shocked me a bit about, you know, here we have these weapon systems. They seem to be everywhere now. Mm-hmm. And then in Israel, I started to cover a lot more defense technology for defense news. And I found that I realized basically one out of every three stories I was covering had usually to do with drones. Either it was about new types of drones themselves, or new types of systems to shoot them down, like Iron Dome or lasers. Or it was about all the interesting add-ons and gadgets that you stick on them, like artificial intelligence or radars or optics and things like that. So I felt that, you know, here someone should write a book about this. There wasn't a book out there. And I started to make a bunch of calls and see who I could interview and how I could learn about, you know, the history of this and also where it's going in terms of the future.
Mm-hmm. So what you mentioned, Iron Dome, the Iron Dome can shoot down drones?
Mm-hmm. Iron Dome system was developed about 10 years ago. So that would be 2011. It was developed in the wake of the 2006 war, when Israel had basically had Hezbollah rockets raining down. And then there was the threat from Gaza with Hamas. Those were just rockets. Iron Dome was developed to basically deal with, you know, you have a rocket, it gets shot, it has a trajectory, radar identifies it, the missile decides whether or not to engage it, and it shoots it down. Over time, Israel realized, well, rockets are just one type of threat, and rockets do this. But drones are a different type of threat, and they might, you know, buzz around. Right. We need to be able to shoot them down as well. Well, we have a system with these cool rockets. We can detect the drones that are buzzing around, so all we need to do is figure out a way to make the rockets, you know, go after them.
And lock onto
the Iron Dome system in May of this year, 2021. In May of 2021, during the recent conflict with Gaza, the Iron Dome system for the first time shot down an enemy drone, at least publicly for the first time. Mm-hmm. And that shows that it has a nuclear ability. And I would assume, you know, they're going to keep adding on capabilities. They say they'll start to put lasers on the system eventually, maybe in the future.
Right. Well, because one of the problems with the Iron Dome, as effective as it is that the cost is quite prohibitive. I mean, if it's going to be, you know, whatever it is, $50,000 or whatever the number is that they float around for each one, that's a pretty hefty price tag. Yeah. To shoot down something that's fairly unsophisticated, right? I mean, how much does it cost? Like the drones coming out of Gaza?
Well, I think they're getting more sophisticated as well. That's the problem, which is Iran's drones, which are being trafficked either through blueprints or direct trafficking of the machines or taking up parts of them to places like Yemen, Gaza, Syria, Lebanon, Iraq. These drones are getting more and more sophisticated. I just had an attack on a ship 3 days ago with
Yes, right.
drones. And so that shows that they're becoming much more dangerous. And everyone in the region needs to know how to shoot them down and needs to be aware of the danger.
So, I mean, I guess it's like with every type of weaponry, you have to stay, your enemy is going to develop it or have already developed even before you did. You have to stay one step ahead of them. So, I mean, are you confident that Israel can do that from, and I'm sure there's things you can't say publicly, but from what you understand, are we able to do that?
Yeah, I think Israel is pretty well aware of the threat. Israel has, I'm pretty sure, pretty good intelligence on the types of things out there. I think the big problem, as we saw this with the attack on the ship, is that you can't put counter drone systems everywhere. It's hard to secure commercial things like ships. So you have the technology, but there are always going to be enemies that will try to find a way around it. So, for instance, what do you do when an enemy decides to, send 30 drones against a target? Or what happens when they fly a very long distance from a place like Yemen? Or what happens when they fly very, very low? So, I think at the end of the day, those are the kind. It's not just drones. It's also precision-guided munitions and things that maneuver. Any maneuvering munition that does things like a cruise missile that goes low, I think those are always difficult to find, identify, and then shoot.
I mean, this might sound like a stupid question, but bear with me here. How would you define a drone? In my mind, it's this like little thing, right? But could it even be, the size of like a helicopter or essentially, what's the definition? An unmanned flying object? I mean, how what's the basic definition of a drone?
Right. So I think originally we're talking about what is called a remote piloted vehicle or remote piloted aircraft, which means a remote control and an aircraft that you just take the person out of it, it flies around. So in America, the big drones were usually these the Predators and the Reaper drones, which are the size of an aircraft. And in Israel as well, I mean, Israel developed drones in the 70s and 80s that are, like a small plane kind of. So that's what people thought of in some ways as drones, like what we call UAVs, unmanned aerial vehicles. But there are, of course, the commercially available small drones, and those are also used by militaries now. Militaries are building all sorts of little drones. They're using things that, like, you can stick in a backpack and you can chuck it out and it will fly around. So, and there's lots of interesting drones out there that are what's called kamikaze drones, which is what the Iranians use, which are basically have a warhead in the drone. So the
Oh
drone
my God.
itself is designed to destroy itself. And that is more dangerous because all they have to do is program the machine to fly into a target, and they don't even have to be in the loop guiding it. They just tell it where to go, and then it goes there. And
And just blows
you
up.
have to shoot it down.
Wow.
Yes. So
Wow.
that's what was used to attack the ship. That's what they think.
Yeah, that seems to have upped the tension here considerably because, I mean, it's not like in general, I think the borders got blurry between war fields and civilians already many decades ago. I mean, way before 9/11, right? It used to be in the olden days, you had Gettysburg or you had whatever the Maginot Line, and that was like the clear definition of war. And now, with all these guerrilla and terror groups, you have it can be anywhere at any time. It could be an airplane flying into an office building, in downtown Manhattan. So it seems like the drones have really taken that even a further step because you can just invade any space anywhere and cause tremendous havoc.
Yeah, that's the big problem with drones is you can use them and no one knows where they come from necessarily. And if not, you can try to jam them in things, but they can be used in terrorist attacks. Drugs can be smuggled with drones. I mean, it's not always you don't always know where, who sent the thing. So I think that terrorists and countries that engage in terror, like Iran, I think are a big problem. And also, of course, other countries that like to use drones. In places where, let's say, there are weak states, like across the Sahara in Africa, there's lots of countries that are using drones there. They're being used to hunt terrorists as well. So that's a positive, I mean, I guess. But the thing is, yes, they have a lot of flexibility that have like a manned aircraft or a helicopter doesn't have because you've got people in it. You don't want to lose it. So that has, yeah, it has lots of interesting attributes.
I mean, in some way, it makes it seem like borders are like anachronistic. I mean, like you just said, not even war, let's say drug smuggling. So somebody could just throw a drone up in Mexico, go across into Texas with some, I don't know, a few kilos of cocaine or heroin or whatever it is that they're doing. And the guy sitting at the booth down on the, you know, the border post is completely irrelevant.
Yes, that's why probably borders are going to have a lot more of drone detection systems and smart fencing and all sorts of interesting things out there. But, you know, it's not just it's not just a bad thing. I mean, drones can do good right. things as well. Like there's a I'll give you an example. I think Elbit has put life preservers on them. So you can, for instance, use them to do maritime rescue. So let's say you have a ship or plane that goes down, rather than tasking manned aircraft to fly around in circles for hours and hours where the people get tired when they're flying and don't see the bodies or whatever. You just send up a drone up there. The drone, you could send the drones fly around. The drones have, you know, the artificial intelligence to detect, you know, things that they see and tell someone, oh, we see what we think is a body or whatever, or a living being, a person. So, and then we can drop life preservers or rafts. So I would think, you know, drones can probably chart deforestation. They can chart, global warming, you know, they can probably do all sorts of interesting things. They can probably find whales or whatever. Like, you can probably do good things, lots of good things with them as well, I think. So it's a question of what you want to use them for.
Right. Well, I know, I mean, for example, here in Israel, they have these search and rescue units, like in the Judean Mountains, there's always people who get lost. And it's very difficult to find them, and there's cliffs, and usually their phones don't work. There's no reception out in these areas. And one of the search and rescue units in Megillot, I know they have a drone. And they could send it up to look for people who they know have gotten lost, maybe fallen off a cliff, broken bones, or worse situation, without endangering the rescue team who would have to go into these very same situations to find them. And then when they have their coordinates, they can even send them water or some kind of medical equipment if they're injured until whoever's rescuing them can actually get to them. So without a doubt, they do some really incredible, you know, wonderful things. And who knows? I mean, we may start getting deliveries by drone at our front door, right? Amazon Prime will just start dropping boxes with drones by our front door, or pizza for dinner. Or I don't know, like, I guess literally the sky is the limit when it comes to that. But you go through in the book, it's very interesting for anybody who's interested, the research and the mess ups and the costs and how, you know, they first had this idea and the first designs didn't work, as of course you wouldn't expect them to. And you do very extensive research on this, by the way. Did anything surprise you on the way? Or it seemed like pretty like normal trajectory of that development of that kind of thing. Something that stood out?
No, well, that's, you know, I think one thing that does surprise me a bit is how slow militaries are to recognize how, you know, cool and revolutionary this is.
Really?
And, you know, you have, especially in America, military procurement is so slow. They spent $1 billion or whatever building a drone called the Aquila that never even worked. I mean, it was a machine that was supposed to do all sorts of cool things. And in the end of the day, they decided to scrap it because it didn't do half the things they wanted it to do. So I think that what's amazing to me is the technology was there to give, you know, platoon levels, let's say infantry soldiers, access to drones. And you just mentioned, well, there's a search and rescue team and they have a drone. Usually it is actually, I've interviewed one police unit where they were like, yeah, well, we have like one or two drones. And I'm like, yeah, but why don't you have like 50 of them? You know,
really?
Like, how come every guy doesn't have them? Or why is it? I was on a British warship recently and I asked them, well, you know, they have a helicopter in the back of the ship. And I said, well, where's the drones? They said, well, we don't use them. We had one last year. We were experimenting with it. I said, well, this seems crazy. I mean, why are you putting people in a chopper? It's an anti-submarine warship to search for submarines. Use drones to do this. Why are there people in there? I mean, so the degree to which, you know, militaries are slow, even police departments and things, to adopt the new technology, and they're doing, you know, why would you need to do high speed car chases when you can send drones to chase things? I mean, why would you risk people's lives? I mean, there's all sorts of uses for this, for these machines. A lot of them are probably good uses, and you can certainly help soldiers save their own lives in battle, because if I can send drones into a house, I can see the enemy. I don't need to go in myself. And I went to a demonstration recently with Raphael where they had a robotic dog and a drone.
And the dog and the drone actually worked together to go in the rooms and find and look for things, wow, which is great. But this is, you say to yourself, wait, didn't this technology exist a bit ago? Like, why is it so slow? How come not everyone has this? And I think the degree to which really wealthy militaries are really, really slow adopting technology, and they're a bit reticent to use. You know, you think of things like the iPhones. Militaries lack a lot of things that are like that. They don't have really, they're only beginning to really digitize their forces. So things that are obvious to us, like, well, yeah, but we use Waze or whatever. Like, mm-hmm, a lot of, yeah, military machinery is a bit clunky. It's surprisingly clunky. Like, and look, I understand militaries don't want to just play around with things because people can die. If the thing doesn't work, then people die. So I understand. And then drones have to be rugged. Like, if you're in the military, it needs to survive hot temperatures, cold, dust. I mean, because if I have a commercial drone, it gets dust on it and it breaks. Oh, well, I understand they have to make these things like military spec. Mm-hmm. But, you know, they have billions of dollars. So do it. I mean, why, I mentioned the search and rescue thing. Actually, there should be lots of drones doing that. And I don't think they are. When they lost that Malaysian aircraft or whatever, that thing that went missing, I mean, how come there weren't drones out there looking for it? I don't know. I just think that, you know, it's a no-brainer. And I think a lot of rich countries are quite slow. It's not a surprise that poor countries are slow. It's fine. These are expensive things. But mm-hmm, we're the startup nation in Israel, so we can be doing a bit more.
Yeah, it seems like the bad guys have no problem getting this kind of technology. They have to be lean. They have to be mean. And, you know, they're going to get it done, whatever it takes. So that's interesting, because now you're throwing the political or the power or the budgets into this. Like, you know, why would, I don't know, so the Air Force, if, you know, they're going to ask for a lot of money, if drones don't cost all that much, then they can't really ask for as much. I don't know. That's an interesting equation, because not everything is as efficient as it should be for reasons that go way beyond the purview of this particular podcast anyway. And I think unless somebody's extremely naive, they know that. You've got a chapter on the future, like the two, it's called Two Schools, what the future of war will look like. So you want to just elaborate a little bit on that for our listeners?
Yeah, I mean, I think there is a debate, I mean, probably being had now about, you know, what's the roadmap for these systems? And I think that, you know, I think I mentioned in the book that Elon Musk, who, met, you know, he does the Teslas and stuff, he had mm-hmm, given a speech to these pilots and said, you know what, if F-35s were up against drones, we could build drones that will defeat them. Wow. And, you know, of course, a lot of people say, well, that's not really true. F-35s are pretty advanced. I mean, I think, you know, there are two schools of thought about, like, how far do we want to go in terms of investing in autonomous systems with artificial intelligence, because a lot of people are afraid of what they call killer robots. You know, like, do you want to have the machines decide for you, like, who's a terrorist and who's not? I mean, and they, people say, yeah, but there's a person in the loop. But what happens when there's not a person in the loop? What mm-hmm, happens when the machines are making rapid decisions that are wrong? Now, look, at the end of the day, drones are going to be deployed soon, for instance, apparently in robotic vehicles on the border of Gaza. That's a program that it will apparently be rolled out soon. So these things are coming. I mean, the degree to which, you know, the person is controlling them, I think the person will very much be controlling them. But I think there are questions about, you know, where they're going. I think there's questions about whether U.S. adversaries like China will invest massively in drones that can be used in massive swarms. We already see them swarming in light shows and stuff. So what's to stop 1,000 drones from doing a light show as opposed to 1,000 little warheads flying at an aircraft carrier? And I don't think an aircraft carrier can shoot down 1,000 little drones. So that would be difficult. You know, is that another type of Pearl Harbor? Maybe. I think also there's a lot of question about, if you put all this technology in the hands of soldiers, do you take away, you know, some of their, what they call situational awareness of things that you were used to, and they just get reliant totally on technology? And then what happens when you go into a war where the enemy has a technology that can all of a sudden make all of these systems stop working or something, you know, like, and you're too reliant on them? Because I think we all have that feeling with the iPhone, you know, like, what if I lose this? I don't have Waze anymore. Nothing will work. I'm basically like in the dark ages, and I can't figure anything out. And I don't even know the numbers of my friends, you know, like, because I never have to dial them. So it's like, you know, right, technology can be a danger as well, probably. And what, if your soldiers are all on a net, for instance, what if it's a cyber attack or it gets hacked? I mean,
right.
You know, so that's this is a big problem. So I think mm-hmm. that's where we'll see. That's part of another part of the issue identified was this issue of making sure that every infantry platoon or battalion or whatever has drone operators. I mean, you have a guy or women in cases, I mean, where is an expert and is a medic or a sniper or a squad automatic rifle or whatever. So you have all these tough kids or whatever, the special
different jobs,
in the unit,
right.
Yes. Where's the drone? Where's the drone person? I think we need to get to the point where, you know, every single unit has a drone operator. And that person carries in their backpack three or four types of drones, less surveillance, one of these kamikaze type drones, you know, different mm-hmm. has a weapon on it, things like that. So,
or thermal detection or whatever.
We'll get there, yeah. I think.
Mm-hmm. But it's just that so, we have to stay one step ahead of the enemy. Who'll have it too.
Yeah. So, yeah. Look, in our case in Israel, the enemy, it's such an asymmetric war for their enemy doesn't have access to any of that high-level technology, but they do have access to things still like drones that are deadly. So yeah, you have to stay one step ahead of that as well, and you want to make sure also that when you go to war, you're not killing civilians, so you hopefully use the technology to be more lethal, but more lethal towards enemies and not towards civilians. So that's obviously something hopefully technology can help with as well.
Right. I mean, at least that's Israel's concern, to avoid civilian casualties on both sides. there's our neighbors, if anything, you know, might feel a little differently, and that makes things a bit easier for them, I suppose. I just want to like segue a little bit because, like you mentioned, you were on a British warship. And so as a journalist, you know, most of us think of a journalist as just kind of covering stories and then writing it up very well. And then we get to read them and hear what's going on in places that we don't have access to. But you're more than just a journalist, because you're also like a high tech geek to some degree. Like, you love this stuff. How do you like combine the two? I mean, do you find yourself asking a lot of questions when you go in? You're not necessarily going to be able to write up, because it's beyond the intelligence of your average reader, just, you know, because most of us don't understand this stuff. But also because, I mean, to some degree, are they trusting you when they let you into places that this is not going any further? How does that work exactly? Because you're in a very specialized kind of journalism of your own making and of your own curiosity. So how does that work? Again, without giving names and without outing anybody or whatever it is, what can you tell us about that side of it?
Well, it's interesting. I mean, I think a lot of times I'm a bit lucky. I do several different things. So I usually can be doing one story about one thing and still collecting information for something else down the road that I might just file away in my mind or take notes on and then put it somewhere. So when I went on the British warship, I mean, I was invited there. I almost think I wasn't even necessarily going to write a story about it. It was just like a courtesy invite because the Jews imposed something else. So I went. It was supposed to be just kind of for fun. But I mean, we were asking the guys a bunch of different questions and stuff. So I think I ended up writing a story about it. But definitely I was able to collect other information and stuff that I thought, like, well, one day I could reference this as at least as an anecdote, even if it's not on the record. Mm-hmm. And in other cases, I think with the defense companies, it's a bit different, because at the end of the day, you know, defense companies, there are things they want coverage for, because defense companies are still companies. They want to sell things. So when they build a new product, unless it's some clandestine secret program, but if they build a new, let's say a new camera or whatever that could go on a drone or whatever. So, well, that they're going to release it. They usually have a press briefing, or they invite you in. Sometimes it's like something where they just invite one or two journalists to build some hype or whatever. I mean, sometimes they just put out a press release and send you pictures and stuff. So I think that in those cases, you know, they usually want to showcase the thing because they think it's cool, mm-hmm. and they want you to write about it. And yeah, you can always ask lots of questions, and sometimes you can ask questions about other things. To learn, to get a sense of where warfare is going, because I'm always covering the digital battlefield. Even though I'm actually not that much of a tech geek, I'm interested in war. I'm interested in war. I've been to lots of wars. I'm interested in as a historian a bit. I mean, I don't actually know enough about the tech, but I am interested in learning about it. So I try to ask the right questions. And sometimes for a recent story I did, I actually called a friend of mine who was a former special forces guy in the US. And I said to him, listen, I'm about to go see something really interesting. I can't tell you that much about it, but I want you to tell me what kind of questions I should ask, because this is a thing that's going to be used maybe by special forces or infantry soldiers. Would you have liked to have had something like this when you were a soldier in Iraq? And so he was actually very helpful in guiding me to ask some questions, because I was never an infantry soldier, and there's a lot of things I don't know. And again, like, I'm not a drone operator. I mean, I just recently got to go to a base where they let us in to see the people operating them. When I was doing interviews for the book, you know, I saw pictures, and usually the guys would describe it to me like, well, I sit in this container and one of us has the thing and one of us is doing the sensors and one has a, I've seen movies about it as well, where you see all the TV screens and stuff. So, I mean, but it is kind of cool to then, you know, also get to see it in person. And I think a lot of these organizations are trusting. Look, the companies are not stupid. I mean, when you go to some of these briefings, they take your phone, they take your computer, they take everything away. So that, you know, you wouldn't even be able to photograph anything that you saw that might be a clandestine or whatever. Mm-hmm. In some cases, they'll put stickers in the phones or whatever, so that you can find pictures. In some cases, they're just trusting and say, listen, please don't, you know, whatever you take, please don't take photos or whatever. So it depends. But I mean, these organizations know how to deal with media. Usually, I think that, you know, they're in terms of situation awareness. They understand, by the way, even if I take a picture by mistake at a place and put it on my Twitter account, like maybe it's just a selfie or something, there's all these people online that can look in the background and do a geolocation and be like, oh, wait a sec, look where you were. So, you know, these people understand you have to be pretty careful with this type of stuff.
Mm-hmm. Has there been situations where you realized that if you reported on something, it could put someone in danger or the country in danger? Like, where you've had to make, because, you know, some of what you've spoken now about are ethical issues. You know, like, if you have everything that's computerized, where does the soldier and his decision-making come into play? Do we want the machine making the decision of, this is a terrorist, this isn't a terrorist, right? But you probably have that in your job and what you're covering. Have there been situations like that where you, within yourself, as an Israeli or as a Westerner or whatever it is, said, like, I'm not gonna put this out because I don't know who's gonna be reading this, and it might be somebody who's got, you know, whose desires are inimical to where I want this to go. Has that ever happened to you?
I think that happens probably all the time, especially if you're covering like a frontline conflict. But on the other side of the coin, Israel has official military censorship. So if you're a journalist, if you publish certain information, you could in theory get in trouble because it is most of it going through a censor. So, Israel is a country that understands the issue, needs of security. And I think everyone understands that. So there's all sorts of things, you know, where you shouldn't report it, or if you do report it, they'll take it out anyway, because, you know, if you get, maybe some cases, for instance, you know, they don't want you to use the name of a person, especially with like pilots and things. They won't. I don't think, you know, you never get to use names.
Right.
So there's all sorts of things out there. I mean, I think you just know the rules of the game a bit, and, you know, you're not trying to get some huge scoop. I mean, like, whatever. And I don't know about putting people in danger. I mean, probably many cases, you know, if you as a journalist can see the tanks sitting behind the trees in the field that are hiding, but yeah, so can everyone on that kibbutz and stuff. I mean, you don't have some super secret no one else has. I mean,
right,
you're just a person. They're not taking you down in some super secret thing and being like, oh, by the way, we'll show you something that doesn't exist, that no one knows exists. I mean, they're not stupid. They know it's, they know their terms. I think journalism is like any industry. It's like anything you do, and there's no shortage of people probably out there that have access to information. I mean, Israel's army is 100,000 people or something. So there's whole huge numbers of soldiers going to bases and things where they're told they don't take pictures here, you know, and they try, most of them apparently don't do what they're told, because you don't hear a lot of like weird scandals out there.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, as a journalist, what do you think about your other journalists, basically? I mean, do you think that in the years that you've been a journalist, that there's still some kind of integrity, or is a lot of people come down on the press now? for editorializing and not just reporting the facts. Have your feelings changed in the last few years since you've become a journalist about the profession itself and about your coworkers, if you will, not necessarily people working with you, but people in the same profession?
I came into journalism as having been, an academic and involved in all sorts of interesting things and a book reviewer and stuff.
So right.
I didn't go into it really wanting to be a journalist. I was interested in covering history and covering big events. And so I never thought of myself necessarily as a workaday journalism. Like I cover conflict and security now because I like to do it. If someone told me, well, tomorrow we're going to make your beat the health beat, I'd be like, yeah, no, I don't want to do that. Some people are willing to cover conflict. Some people are willing to cover conflicts in the Middle East, and they're willing to go cover conflicts in Brazil or whatever. But I don't want to do that. I live here and I'm interested in these conflicts here, and that's what I'm interested in. I don't want to go, cover logging in Siberia. Maybe one day I will. Maybe one day I'd like to be a culinary journalist or write about other things. I love cooking and stuff. So maybe one day, who knows? But I do think that, look, journalism is complicated. I think there are built-in problems. It's a field that budgets have rapidly declined. There's not a lot of writers out there. A lot of content is aggregated or patchwork. There's a search for clicks. There's a lot of clickbait nonsense out there. So I think you do feel as someone who, if you were a writer, that there is a competition that you could spend, days or half a year working on some story or whatever, and like six people read it. But if you just Google online and find like an offensive tweet and immediately write that up, is like, well, so-and-so who's famous wrote a racist tweet when they were drunk. That will get 6 million shares. And then you say to yourself, well, wait, I'm in the wrong profession. I should just write the clickbait things about something offensive, and then people will follow it. So
right.
It's a problem, because if you're trying to do your job ostensibly, it can be depressing, and you can find out, you can also find, I'll give you another example. Like, you may pitch stories and find out that even though you know a lot about something like drones or whatever, and you happen to know a lot about the thing that just happened in the Oman with the ship, even if you have like really great sources and you pitch the stories to people, and people are like, no, we don't want that. We don't want that. And they're like, that's boring. And you're like, really? Like, isn't it kind of like leading the news that you don't want something on it? Like, or they'll tell you, oh no, we have an in-house writer who's covering it, who knows nothing about it, but we've asked them to do it, And you're like,
right.
Yeah, but wouldn't you prefer to speak to someone who's kind of like, or like
an expert?
I was covering the Yazidi genocide. I was covering the mass graves of the Yazidis. That was 7 years ago or so. The genocide victims. I was one of the first people to see some of the mass graves that ISIS left behind, which is kind of stuff like genocidal, like the Holocaust type of things. And I wrote about it in my book. But I remember, sending back and saying, well, we just found a mass grave of like 30 bodies in them. And they'd be like, no, we're not really interested. Well, we have someone here that can write that up. And you're like, yeah, but I have pictures up from here.
Oh my
God. You don't want the pictures, even the pictures? Like, well, we have photographers. It's like, okay, but the photographer's not here. I'm the one here. Your right. photographer is stuck in Baghdad. He or she can't. I'm here. I have information. It's fine. I end up writing articles about it. I wrote a book about it. I put it on websites and stuff.
Right.
But it is disappointing. I think that's the hard thing. And I do think, I do think there is a tragedy of journalism, especially in the West, of because of the search for clicks, people who never leave a newsroom, maybe in a place like Washington or wherever, are writing a lot about things all over the world and having never even been there. And yet their stories are getting shared a bit more than people that actually go to places. Like I know a woman now who's in Gandahar in Afghanistan. And, you have to say to yourself, well, her story should probably be the leading all your sites, not a person writing an analysis piece about the afterlife. But we like the analysis piece because sometimes it's more folksy or whatever, rather than like maybe what she's writing. So I think that's unfair a bit. And I think that, and I do think that there's another problem. Governments in the world control media, Al Jazeera or, TRT or these state-backed networks. Those are the ones with the billion-dollar budgets, and they have all the and Western democratic media is poor, and so it can barely pay the staffers.
Is
that's
it really
not good.
Like
it
CNN? CNN is poor. Yeah,
CNN maybe not, but there's been a lot of thousands of Western newspapers that have closed over the last decades. I mean,
right.
No,
right.
There are a few big networks.
Mm-hmm.
Even those networks that don't have millions of reporters, you know, they have a lot of issues. They have lots of hurdles as well. And so I think that's one thing, you know, that is changing the playing field and allowing dictatorships to have a lot more power. And also corporate companies, whether it's CNN or whatever, look, their corporate bosses have connections with these countries like China or whatever. And you ask yourself, you know, does that change coverage? I mean, is the New York Times not as critical of Turkey? Why might that be? I mean, and you never know how that works. You never know why exactly it is that, you know, some countries that seem like they should get more criticism don't. And is it just bias or is it money? Or what's really going on? We don't know, because we're not always privy to exactly what causes certain stories not to be written.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it can just be a bias of the actual journalist.
Wasn't there a famous story? What was his name? Easton Johnson? There was some reporter who admitted that he gave, I think it was Saddam Hussein, like a major pass, and he didn't report on a lot of things that were going on in Iraq because then he would have lost his access. And so like millions of people's opinions were formed by the stories he was filing, and they were essentially propaganda. But how can you possibly stop that?
I don't know if you can. I mean, I think you have to have powerful Western democratic media institutions that are willing to stand up to dictators as opposed to coddle them. And I think that that's very difficult in the modern age,
right,
when these Western media poor. I mean, if Kim Kardashian was a media company, then she'd have, then they'd have money. But people, but I'll tell you another thing. I think it's a problem in journalism that I see in the West is that because of the declining budgets and the smaller newsrooms, they only hire a few people. So they usually hire people that are their relatives or cousins or friends from high school. And you have, I would say, some of the least diverse spaces. And that, I don't mean just diversity in terms of race, because that's obviously one issue. But I think there's a diversity, and not just opinion, diversity of income backgrounds and geography. So you say to yourself, how many people in some of these newsrooms come from different parts, let's say in a case of America, different parts of America? Or are 80% of them like from New York and Washington, and 60% of them went to the same high schools and colleges? And look, elite universities are great as well, but you should also have people that have gone to a community college or whatever. And when that person goes out to cover a beat like riots or something, my sense is that person will have an easier time getting in and understanding what's happening than someone who's, you know, never been in a bad neighborhood. I would think that will change your coverage. I think newsrooms in the 50s and 60s had a lot more people who came from tough, hardworking, even or military backgrounds or whatever. And they were, you know, their views were informed by the fact that they'd served in World War II or Vietnam, and they'd been in pretty bad situations, and they could make sometimes better judgment calls about things probably based on that. And I think, as opposed to, you know, my hardest experience was when I had to once do my laundry in college. Like, so I think that's a problem. And that's what happens when news are smaller and less money. Because you know what? If there's not a lot of money to pay the journalist, who will be a freelancer? Rich people. Because rich people can freelance because they have other jobs. I mean, or they have just money. So it's like, okay, I don't mind writing stories for free, which is fine. Writing stories for free is cool as well. I mean, probably in the time of, you know, the French salons of the 19th century, they were all wealthy too. It's wealthy people produce great things as well. It's not that you need to hire all blacksmiths to be astronomers. Maybe they may not be good astronomers. It's nothing wrong with that. But you do lose out on something when only rich people can afford to be freelancers. And then you only end up with one type of view. And I think, also, then 80% of your reporting kind of looks the same. They all go to the same place and they write the same story. So they have the same sources, unfortunately, which isn't great, because you want a diversity of sources.
Right. Sometimes I'm torn between thinking that we're getting way too much information and realizing that most of it is garbage. Like, we're not getting real information, as you said, from people who would understand the nuances of where they are. Lies.
It's also all the same. If you go online these days, it's wire services are not bad, but wire services like Reuters and AP and AFP, what they mean is the exact same story is put online by 1,000 different websites that have a subscription to the service. So although you think that you're looking at 20 different websites that all have lots of articles, 80% of the articles are all the same. And so you're actually seeing no information. Actually, if you got up every day and looked at the top 10 news sites, and let's say, I'm not talking about going to the far left or far right, I'm talking about just mainstream news sites, BBC, CNN, whatever, mm-hmm. CNBC, NBC, big ones. Look, open up all of them and look at the top 5 or 10 stories, and they're all kind of the same. And I understand that, look, yeah, you have to cover breaking news. Great. But are you covering anything else? Are there any stories from anywhere in Africa or anywhere in South America? What, are there whole continents where nothing happened today? Are there whole continents where nothing happened all year in your newsroom? How's that possible? Well, that's not good. So, and then they're surprised when there's like some huge war or whatever in Ethiopia. And then they all have to send their journalists there because no one bothered to tell anyone that, well, you know, there's a war breaking out. So that's not great. That's why I committed a genocide, to be honest. There weren't that's not the only reason, but there weren't enough journalists to warn us that ISIS was a Nazi-like organization. We were told, by the way, ISIS was insurgents. They weren't insurgents. That's as much as calling like the Nazis were insurgents. No, they weren't. They were planning a genocide. They took tens of thousands of people. They took thousands of women. They systematically raped them and killed them. And there were not enough people to cover it until it was happening. Then everyone was covering it. But there wasn't enough to do to save them. So that's not great.
Mm-hmm. Wow. I see how much that whole experience affected you. You know, and as Israelis, it seems like there's this incredible obsession with Israel. Like what you just said, sometimes I'll open, I don't know, some random thing and I'll say, didn't anything happen anywhere else besides Jerusalem yesterday? Like, what is it with this focus on Israel and every single thing that we do? It's not a compliment. It starts being, I mean, it's not starts, it's for a long time. Do you think there's something unnatural about that? I mean, do you have an explanation for that?
I think the overall, why is there so much coverage of Israel? And you say, okay, how much of it is legitimate coverage? I.e. there is a conflict here. People do die sometimes. Mm-hmm. That would be like, okay, so that's about 10% of what actually should be covered.
Right.
The rest of it, I think you have to say there's different things going on here. There's the kind of, let's say, part of it, anti-Semitic aspects, but there's also the Judeo-Christian aspect of, yeah, but it's Jerusalem. The Jews are there. Jesus was there. Islam is there. Oh, great. They're all in the same place. Let's cover it. So it's kind of unique because in other cases, you might have one or the other, but you don't have all these people in the same place. So that brings people in. And then I think you also have this kind of cliche that it's an easy story to cover. It's already kind of been written about. So you have a paradigm of, we understand the conflict, because if we were asked to suddenly have 1,000 news stories about Eritreans fighting the Ethiopians, we'd have to spend a lot of time educating people. And most people would be, I really just don't care about that. Quiet, secretly what they say is, I don't care because for certain reasons, but people care. Conflict here because people tell them they're supposed to care, so they think it's a really important conflict. And then I think they therefore you have a vicious cycle. And there's, and also it's so easy to cover this conflict. Right. You can fly in to yesterday from London or Paris or wherever, and tomorrow you can be in Ramallah, which is the conflict zone. Mm-hmm. But most people don't get hurt there. You come back and have coffee and drinks and beer on the beach in Tel Aviv. It's kind of the most bourgeoisie awesome conflict to cover. Where else can you get that? You want to go to Ethiopia and cover the war there? Okay. No beach, no beer. I mean, there's great beer in Ethiopia, but it's not quite the same joie de vivre. So, I mean, that sounds racist and whatever, but that the reality is media want to go cover places that have an easy of access. I mean, you know, if you're a media team, you need a lot of things. First of all, you need some money, but you need a fixer, you need a driver, you need a translator. Well, in Israel, you got it. People speak English. You can get a car. You can get a fixer, whatever. I mean, when I was going back and forth to Iraq, you know, it's difficult. You got to arrange a guy and find the fixer and the driver and hope that person's not going to kidnap you because they're connected to ISIS or something bizarre. Like, you know, half the countries in the world you can't report from because you'll be disappeared. You know, journalists get disappeared in Burma. Journalists get beheaded. I mean, who wants to cover a conflict where there's a 50% chance you won't come back? Mm-hmm. This is a conflict, you know, fair, unfair, where people respect journalists, and basically very rarely do they get targeted or killed. I mean, or disappeared by security services. Whereas in Belarus, you get disappeared. I don't want to be disappeared.
Right.
So I think there's a, that's why it's a multi-layered cake. And of the cake, there's like a part of it that's totally legitimate. And then there's all these layers that lack, have other aspects of legitimacy, but are partly ease of access. And then there's a part that's not legitimate, which is the anti-Semitic part, which is that there's a historical obsession with the Jews. And that's a Western obsession. And that's why I think, to be honest, I think media in many Eastern and Asian countries are not quite obsessed with this conflict.
Right.
Because they, because the whole idea of, oh, you see what the Jews are doing, how they're, you see they suffered in the Holocaust. How could they treat the Palestinians like this? There, that's an anti-Semitic bizarre narrative. Nobody mostly says that about, like, yeah, why are the Burmese hurting the Rohingyas? I mean, that's because no one enters into this weird Judeo-Christian discussion. And I think that's where, you know, that's for better or for worse. For better or for worse, that's a little part of the Western problem,
I think. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm going to agree with you on that. Years ago, a journalist said to me, he said, I love covering Israel because I could be out in whatever war zone and at the American Colony Hotel for happy hour in the same afternoon. And he said, a lot of journalists are just lazy and that it makes it easy for us. Yeah, what you just said.
Well, yeah, I mean, there's another side of journalism, which is people that want the hard war and they want the worst of the worst. They want to go someplace no one has ever been. And that's what they hunger for. And if they even see another journalist, they're like, run away, because they don't want to, they want to be totally unique. I mean, there's a little niche of people like that are bringing back stories from the worst of the worst places, you know, whether it's, I don't know, the wars in Yemen or whatever. And you have real, you know, really heroic, interesting people.
Yeah. And putting themselves in danger, look, which I know you've done too. Okay.
They do. And they do far more work than I do. I mean, I just think that, at the end of the day, you know, journalism is a profession. I mean, you know, if you go into banking or you go into real estate, the chances that you'll be beheaded are pretty slim. And yet there was a time in journalism, a lot of people went to Libya and Syria, and James Foley was beheaded. And Stephen Sotloff, who was connected to Israel and connected to the Jerusalem Post, he was beheaded. I mean, and that doesn't happen, by the way, if you just go into selling used cars and stuff. So it's a profession. People want to live a normal life. They don't want that to happen, you know. Mm-hmm. So that's an entirely legitimate reason to want to go to a 4-star hotel, go out with your team, film the riot, and go back to the hotel.
Right, right, exactly. And then bill it all to the expense account of whatever company sent you there. Okay, all right, Seth Frantzman, thank you so much. Also for really illuminating, I think, for me and for my listeners as well, what it's like to be a historian turned journalist and really. You know, deeply involved with the things that you cover, and then of course putting out books that give us a lot of the background that otherwise we would never have. If any of you are interested, Drone Wars by Seth J. Frantzman. Where is the book available?
Amazon, I'm sure. Book Depository and other places.
The usual.
Probably so you find it online. You can get the audiobook as well. Yeah, audiobooks. By the way, I listened to the audiobook. I approved the person that read it, and I think it's pretty decent, so I'm pretty happy with it. So if you like audiobooks, check it out, listen to it while you drive or run or whatever, or on your next flight, and I hope you'll find it interesting. I loved writing it, and I think it's a cool book. So
yeah, I agree as well. Okay, thank you everybody for listening to the interview with Seth Frantzman on his book Drone Wars, but actually on a whole lot more than that. Eve Harrow, Rejuvenation on the Land of Israel Network. I hope wherever you are well. And I hope to be back next week. Take care, everybody. Goodbye. Oh, thanks to Ben and to Tabitha. Can never forget them. Take care, everybody. Goodbye for now.
My name is Jeremy Gimpel, and I live here in the mountains of Judea. And in these unprecedented times, I wanted to offer you a gift from the Land of Israel. We've been here at the cutting edge of the Jewish return to the Land of Israel. We've come to the place where King David first assembled his men, and where he wrote most of the book of Psalms. We are quite literally transforming this desert mountain area into a Garden of Eden-like oasis. Watching prophecy manifest into reality, we felt called to reach out to the nations, to teach them lessons from the Bible in the original Hebrew, unlocking insights and understandings that you can only get if you read the text in its original language and from a Judean perspective. The prophet Zechariah spoke of a time that 10 men from all the nations will grab hold of the corner of a garment of a Judean man and say, "Take us with you, for we have heard that God is with you." Perhaps this is the time that the righteous among the nations will now make a sharp U-turn and reconnect to Israel, reconnect to Judea, reconnect to the Hebrew roots of the spiritual realities of this world. This is an invitation to join us at our next live gathering with hundreds of families from over 30 countries around the world. And if you register now, we'll give you a free gift from Israel, the first 5 sessions that unlock the secrets of the Hebrew Bible and how to live as a believer in these times. I hope to see you at the Land of Israel Fellowship. Shalom.